5:00. The Cultural and Outdoor Resources Finance Division will come to order March 15th. Thank you so much for your patience. I had nothing to do with it. First item on the agenda today are reports from the Minnesota Session Laws, Chapter 172, reports that were due on March 1st. And the first reporter is Michael Garcia, the president of Duluth Children's Museum. You received funding from the Minnesota Legacy Fund, the Arts and Culture Fund, last year. Tell us how it was used, please.
Thank you very much. Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's my honor and pleasure to be before you this evening to give a progress report and update on the use of funds by the Duluth Children's Museum. I'm very pleased to be able to tell you that the Duluth Children's Museum was rather uniquely poised at the time that the legacy funds became available. And what I mean by that is we were in a long-range strategic plan and an effort to relocate the museum in looking at the way we did business and looking at it differently. What we lacked was a critical funding partner. And the money from the Cultural Heritage Fund that was provided and then released as early as it did provided the financial impetus and security to allow us to expand the programs within the desired outcomes of the museum as well as the intention of the legislation. I also want to commend the state staff, Alyssa in the management office that has handled our grant management has been an amazingly easy person and helpful person to deal with. The flow of funding has been outstanding. Communication has been outstanding with that office, and I've been really pleased and happy to work with her closely in keeping in compliance, making sure all our reports and invoices are on time and all of our materials on time. It's been a pleasure to work with Melissa in that office. The Duluth Children's Museum, and I have this distilled into a short PowerPoint presentation for you. There's a more detailed report in the legislative library and available for you online. But basically, this summary of slides tells you that what the Duluth Children's Museum did is it took the opportunity of funding from the Cultural Heritage Amendment, and it began to implement and expand a program that we call at the museum Passport to Culture. Passport to Culture is a voluntary program that removes economic barriers for children and their families to access opportunities afforded members of the Duluth Children's Museum. We do this program through partnerships with social service and other care providers in our community. And at this point in time of reporting, we have partnership programs with Families in Transition, which is a Head Start program, Lutheran Social Services, Early Childhood and Family Education Child Care Providers in Duluth, Proctor, Hermantown, Cloquet, and Moose Lake, the Head Start programs at Nettleton School, Barnes, Fond du Lac, Stowe MacArthur, Grant, and Lincoln Park Elementary School, Little Treasures Early Child Care Providers, the YMCA Mentor Program, Community Action Duluth, particularly their Circles of Support, ARC Northland, the United Way Big Red Shelf, the YWCA Downtown and Spirit Valley, and most recently we just added the Duluth Superior Symphony Orchestra in their Music to You program as providers. What these partnerships allow us to do are identify families in need. Duluth has a very high percentage of families with household income below the national average of what we would call a livable wage, or 2 times the federal poverty rate. In Duluth, we have approximately 45% of the households with school-age children affected by that low-income status. The Duluth Children's Museum, with legacy funds, is opening the doors for opportunities to ensure that those families and the children that they are raising have the opportunity to have a regular museum visit experience as part of their monthly activity. Since the funding was awarded in July, it took us a few months to get operational and get those partnerships in place. But the well had been primed and we'd been working on that already. We have added to our membership base at the museum 401 new families through this program as of February 28th. Those 401 households represent 884 adults and 1,175 children. To date, the membership in Passport to Culture represents 33.5% of the Duluth Children's Museum membership. By year end, we anticipate that figure to be approximately 42%, or just about mirroring our community demographic of low-income households in the city of Duluth. Our intention with your support is to expand this model and make it regionally available to more families throughout the upper Midwest. The other program we've been able to implement with legacy funding is one we call an early childhood program, or Museum on the Move. Museum on the Move is a trunk program where we take childhood experiences into early child care settings. Within our region, there are many home-based daycare centers that are providing services to 12 or under children, 12 children or less, fewer children. And the intention of this program is to provide a museum experience, but to bring it to the families and the children. Our museum educator has developed a series of topics in consultation with them. She's using the Head Start framework for standards to develop the content. And we're putting together trunks that daycare centers are able to check out for them from the museum at a two-week interval. Based on feedback from the pilot program, we'll be extending that to three-week intervals. I'm very proud and pleased to be able to tell you that on Friday, it was announced that the Lloyd K. Johnson Family Foundation in Duluth has matched the Cultural Heritage Amendment dollars with a $20,000 investment to allow us to expand this program further throughout our region and a little bit into northern Wisconsin. The content areas for the themes of these trunks include the human body, light and color, math matters, music and movement, and spiders and bugs. All topics that child care providers helped us develop and served on a panel that helped inform us and helped the design. We used a logic framework, and the framework is in the more complete report that's at the library and online available to you. And it was a very comprehensive report, and it will lead eventually to longitudinal data and evaluation information. One of the other things, and your affinity for the zoo, Chair Murphy, may be evident here in the slide with this snake. I must admit, they tried to convince me the snake was too heavy for me to pick up, and I accepted their coaching, and I didn't pick it up. The young man who's handling it is now a student at Michigan Tech, but he worked for the museum last summer, and he did, in fact, handle the snake. But the purpose of this slide is to talk briefly about the fact that we have established monthly programs that happen at the museum, and the intention of the programs are to have them free and open to all of the public to try and encourage broader attendance and participation in museum programs. It would be called a teaser program, if you would. We've had a series of them, a flamenco dance duo, global games in the Great Hall of the Depot, Amazing Artifacts, which was a collection-based program based on the strength of the collection of the Duluth Children's Museum, The Snake Man, which was wildly popular, I must say, our first ever Bubble Festival, which drew 1,200 people, Treasure Quest with Scott Mitchin, who is a regionally recognized and nationally recognized author on reading and treasure hunting, and most recently with the University of Minnesota Opera Department, Pirates of the Carrot Bean. Pirates of the Carrot Bean has had a fabulous student following throughout the upper Midwest. It's an outreach program of the Opera Department of UMD, the University of Minnesota Duluth, and those young opera students brought Pirates of the Carrot Bean to the Great Hall of the Depot, entertained over 450 young children in a very exciting, dramatic presentation about healthy life choices and food choices done through music and opera format. This photo is of our first annual Bubble Fest at Heritage Park. When we launched the program, our intention in August was looking at the close of the summer season. What could we do that celebrated families and fun? And we talked a lot about having a kite flying festival, but the bubble festival emerged as a topic that people really got excited about. And we had staff experience where somebody had experience with creating a bubble festival. And so there were a series of interactive booths throughout Heritage Park parking lot. And we had anticipated and budgeted for approximately 400 people to attend. By 12:30 in the afternoon, 1/2 hour before we were scheduled to open, we had over 600 people in the parking lot of Heritage Park. The event was scheduled from 1 to 4. It went from 12:30 when we finally just pulled the gate down and opened up to the public, and it went until 6 p.m. that night. And we estimate we had 1,700 people in total there, 1,200 at any one time. Dramatically changing the community's experience there, partnering with the Heritage Sports Center and with the Boys and Girls Club, where over 160 people who had never skated before or got on a climbing wall participated in indoor activities as well. The Duluth Children's Museum is emerging as an exhibit developer. Providing regular exhibit changeovers is a critical part of every children's museum effort to keep its experience fresh and new to the visitor. Through the funding with the Cultural Heritage Amendment and augment it with $381,000 in federal funding, the Duluth Children's Museum has now opened a fabrication studio. By this I mean we are able to create our own exhibits based on the strength of our expertise in Duluth and our collection of the museum. Collaborations that are emerging are leading to a paleontology program, which will launch in spring 2010. Given the weather this last weekend, I think we might be behind schedule. Spring has come, summer's there today, it's 62 in Duluth. We are also working with the Duluth Superior Symphony Orchestra again. They are featuring the Moss Ensemble, music, architecture, sound, and sculpture. And on April 11th, the day after their major public performance and fundraiser, we are going to be announcing this week a family concert that will be paid for by local dollars to allow Mass Ensemble to stay in Duluth and to open first to the membership of the Duluth Children's Museum, so every child will have an opportunity to attend a free concert, make their own instrument, interact with the musicians, and see the world's largest stringed instrument. The themes that we're following in our planning and activity are consistent with the framework that the Framework Committee submitted to this body. We are working very close at the Duluth Children's Museum to evaluate our programs to make sure that we are addressing issues of access and engagement. By engagement, what we mean is the actual participation by the attendees in the activities we sponsor. We are stretching ourselves for new collaboration. Since the Heritage Bill was passed and the funds were made available and the Framework Committee began to hold meetings statewide, the opportunity for collaboration has become deep and meaningful for the Children's Museum. We've appreciated the stimulus and the stimulation of the creation of partnerships, likely and unlikely, that are occurring as a result of this funding. Evaluation is a driving force behind what we do. It will inform us both on an ongoing basis and in a continuous improvement model to make sure that we are assessing the effectiveness and the outcomes of our efforts. And most importantly, we are looking at sustainability. What I can tell you is that funding from the Heritage Amendment has greatly increased the attendance and activity at the Duluth Children's Museum. We see more happy faces and more young children on a daily basis. We also have the belief that we are becoming much more sustainable as an entity. These are hard economic times. Foundation dollars are very hard to secure, and the Children's Museum had one of its worst years in 5 years a year ago in raising private foundation dollars. What we are seeing is the private sector and the foundation sector's interest in supporting the Children's Museum based on the investment from the cultural legacy funds is coming very rapidly and very successfully. private business is funding the collaboration with the Moss Ensemble. So Todd Johnson of Rubin Construction. The Lloyd K. Johnson Family Foundation's investment. I will be doing a presentation at the Junior League of Duluth tomorrow night where they will announce a grant to the Duluth Children's Museum. All of this is happening in part because through the funding provided from the Legacy Amendment, we are able to convince our community with good reason that the Duluth Children's Museum has a role to play in serving the needs of the families of Duluth and the greater Duluth area. I thank you so much for your investment. And this is one picture that I really would like you to look at and see Marcus, if you can, up there. This young man came into the museum and captured my heart, and he was carrying that basket. He's become a little bit of a poster child for me in fundraising, because I look at Marcus and I think, who would not fill his basket and keep it full of those things that he needs? Through your investment in children, we are investing in everybody's future. Together, I ask that we work to keep Marcus's basket of opportunities and hope full. Thank you so much. I'd be glad to answer any questions you have at this time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Director, Mr. President Garcia. I want you to know that Mrs. Lloyd K. Johnson was a kind of a mentor to me. When I got out of college and joined the AAUW, she kind of shepherded me through my first few years in that organization and made sure that I showed up from time to time and was a very good example for an enthusiastic community member that always worked for good causes. So I'm not surprised to see the name of the foundation investing in your in the Children's Museum.
Thank you, Chairman Murphy. And in fact, Mrs. Johnson, the first Mrs. Lloyd Johnson, served on the Board of Trustees of the museum back in the 1950s, so she has been a friend to the museum.
She was a pretty special lady.
For many years. Thank
you. Yes. Any other questions? Well, thank you so much. It looks like you're on the right track. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Garcia. I think you're doing a lot of great things, and I love to see the museum on the move, reaching out to early childhood. I would just say, rather than looking to the east, you mentioned northern Wisconsin, I would encourage you to look to the west. I see you as a resource for all of Minnesotans, and since these are Minnesota paid dollars, if you could reach out more to the west, that would be great.
Absolutely. We're moving west, and we will move. I just recently joined the Cloquet Hospital Foundation Board of Trustees with the intention of bringing educational opportunities and healthcare and things to the to Cloquet and then Aiken and that region. So, Chair, members of the committee, we're very aware of that and very focused on the segregation of our dollars in Minnesota, but also recognizing that Superior is a close partner, and when we get funding from the Congress, Congressman Obie is certainly an influential member of our community and spheres of influence, so we have to be aware of their needs without using our state dollars that way. But a point well taken.
Madam Chair, I always believe in all of our organizations being strategic in their partnerships.
Thank you.
Mr. Garcia, you talked about child care. I think it was the child care that you're doing with Duluth, Proctor, Moose Lake, and who else? There was one other.
Duluth, Proctor, Moose Lake, Hermantown. Yes.
Oh.
Hermantown.
Oh.
Chair Murphy. How could I forget Hermantown?
All right. Thank you for that information. Thanks a lot. Minnesota Children's Museum. Denise Bossy, welcome back.
Thank you. It's good to see you again, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. I do want to, first of all, before I get started on our report, thank you all for this wonderful management of the cultural heritage funds. We are very grateful for the opportunities that it is allowing us to carry out for the children in Minnesota. And we also want to take this opportunity to thank the taxpayers of Minnesota who voted to include this sort of funding for cultural and arts organizations. I just wanted to take a moment, since I was here last week, and I feel like I addressed a lot of our history at the museum. We are a statewide organization. We serve just over 400,000 families, children, and school groups each year. 18% of our visitors come from greater Minnesota, and 10% come from outside of Minnesota. So we do have a far reach throughout. We reach 85 of 87 counties, and 37 counties in Minnesota send school groups to the museum. And that number in school groups is about 65,000 children and teachers that come to the museum each year. And that is in part through our access program, which enables us to offer free or reduced opportunities to those children. I want to now go to the funding that you have awarded us, and what we, the project that we chose actually was something that we had been looking at doing for several years, but did not have the funding, and of course hit a bump in the road when the financial markets crashed and our admissions went down and our charitable contributions went down as well. We were actually able to resurrect this project, which we think is going to be very meaningful for the state, for families and for children, and for all people working in early childhood care and education. It is called Building Early Literacy Together, and it is a twofold, two outputs of exhibits. One is called Minnesota Reads, which is based on the larger exhibit of Bound to Read. These are literacy-based exhibits that are sorely needed in the field of children's museums, but also as literacy is pretty much the cornerstone of all types of learning, we know that these sorts of informal learning opportunities through exhibits are going to be critical in assisting our children to develop the disposition to read and the love of reading. We have seven books that will be featuring in the larger Bound to Read exhibit. Some of you may be familiar with these books, at least I hope you are. If You Give a Mouse a Cookie, Abuelo, The Snowy Day, Chicka Chicka Boom Boom, Peter Rabbit, Tuesday, and Where's Spot? So if you have small children or grandchildren, you've probably read those books a couple of times. I know that I have to my four-year-old. The exhibits are based on the books. The Bound to Read will feature all seven books, and at this point, Minnesota Reads will feature four books. Our plan and sort of the final output of Building Early Literacy Together is to help build and develop a strategic statewide network of communities that are highly engaged around literacy, particularly early childhood literacy and how those skills are developed. And we currently work with all Metro Head Starts in the Metro, Seven County Metro area, and we hope to expand our relationship with community-based organizations and other museums throughout the state as we tour these exhibits to develop partnerships that will offer meaningful opportunities for families to engage around literacy, to develop the love of reading with their children, and also for teachers who teach young children, providers, caregivers, and of course elementary teachers that bring their school groups. So this is really an impactful, I believe, an impactful way that these dollars will not just create something that will be nice for people to see, but also something that will leave a lasting impact. And we hope it's something that you know, people say, "Oh, I remember when I saw that and read those books." To date, what we have done is to, and I believe in our proposal, if you had an opportunity to read the full proposal, our project's official project start date was not until January of this year. And so we don't have leaps and bounds to report at this point in time. But what we have done is to convene an advisory board of literacy specialists, and leaders throughout the state to start forming the sort of the academics that go into the exhibit production. And they have advice on the content development, on the community sites and needs, and the process and context. So as also as part of developing those exhibits and developing our community partnerships, we are working with SEED to help inform us as to how we best create those partnerships. So we're not just going in and stepping on people's toes, but we're doing it in a way that the community would really like us to form these partnerships and to make these exhibits available. The last thing in terms of our objectives is that we really hope to develop a high-quality, state-of-the-art exhibit in both Bound to Read and in Minnesota Reads. We want to form a diverse advisory board. So we have typically in exhibit development one advisory board that will sort of start off on the seed of the exhibit, and then we pull from various community members around. This will be a statewide advisory panel to really inform on all levels of the exhibit, and that is in our research and development, prototyping, and everything that goes in, that's involved in developing that exhibit. We also will maintain a high-quality child and family-focused educational programming. I'm sure that you are all familiar with us and know that we do quite a bit of programming through our discovery trunks, through our on-site programming, through our education and professional development of providers and educators. And so we will develop materials that will be specific to these exhibits, and we'll hopefully engage in a very deep manner whole communities around early childhood literacy. We will ensure that best practices are involved in all of our exhibits and in our programming and in the way that we reach out to communities, and that we will engage adults and children in reading in literacy-focused play. We will also ensure that Bound to Read is accessible. So we currently, right now, have about 30% of the folks that visit us do so at a free or greatly reduced rate, and I mentioned that earlier. And we will make sure that Bound to Read is accessible to the public, and moreover, that Minnesota Reads will be available on a free basis to all of the sites that we send it to and that agree to host it. So that will be free, and that will be, in a sense, the exhibit for the children of Minnesota. We will create the strategic partnerships that I mentioned earlier with a range of organizations, and we will engage communities across the state in early childhood learning and development. So our status right now is that we have convened the advisory panel and the advisory board, and from that meeting and knowledge, we were able to complete the conceptual development incorporated throughout the exhibit. And we have concept sketches that were formed, and these are also helping us to gain other funding from other funders. And as Michael Garcia mentioned earlier, one of the things that has been a real asset is that we can say, well, we have cultural legacy funding, which covers about a third of the entire project. And it really does make our potential funders very happy to know that they will be in partnership with something greater than themselves, in a way. And so that has been a really wonderful asset to have going into a project, is having some dollars to start with. We've also secured book rights for the three properties that do need to have the rights purchased for a period of time. And we're right now in the process of starting to do some building on the Minnesota Reads component of the entire exhibit. So right now, for the 3 months that we've actually been at work on the project, I think that we've accomplished a lot. We've hired the staff that we need to, so we've added some jobs, which is a good thing in this economy. And now we're moving forward with getting the building and the larger concept for Bound to Read completed and designed.
Sounds good. What did you mean by book rate? You were getting book rates.
Rights.
Right.
We have to purchase the rights to certain properties. For instance, when we had our Curious George exhibit, in order to create the exhibit, we had to purchase the rights to use Curious George and all the branding and all of that. And so we have to do that with Wear Spot, If You Give a Mouse a Cookie, and The Tale of Peter Rabbit.
Peter Rabbit's pretty old. Isn't that public domain?
Apparently not, Madam Chair. I don't know. I can't answer that. We did have to purchase it. So.
Huh. Representative Kahn.
That was my question. I didn't know. Thought there was some limitation. That seems like we're looking
Beatrice
at 100
Potter
years.
Must still be around. Give a Mouse a Cookie. Peter Rabbit. What was the other one?
Wear Spot.
Okay, and Curious George. Okay,
well, I was just using that as an example. The other books that we have are Abuelo, which is actually a picture book. We want to explore literacy as pictorial as well. Some of the elements in being able to follow a story visually are highly related to being able to develop the skill set to actually read the words. So we're, you know, and that's really designed for some of the really young learners that are going to be experiencing this exhibit.
Wonderful. Yeah. Ms. Fosse, after last year's appropriations, were you contacted by other groups in the state like Mankato and Rochester and some of the especially in southeastern Minnesota or south central Minnesota, because they were thinking of, or they were beginning children's museums too, and did they contact you and ask to work with you?
Madam Chair, that's a great question. I was just in Rochester this morning, actually. As far as I know, the Mankato folks have not contacted the museum in regards to some partnership or help in setting up their museum. However, we do, and this was in the paper a couple of weeks ago, we have signed a letter of understanding with the board of directors of the Children's Museum of Rochester. It will now be, what we're doing right now is exploring the potential of creating a satellite of the Minnesota Children's Museum located in Rochester. This would be a museum that would be focused on STEM largely and the body and health being located very closely to the Mayo Clinic. We're in the process of looking at and exploring buildings. We are adding some of their board members to our larger board here. And we have also approached the federal government for some seed dollars to start something there. And based on their market and feasibility studies, we know that they desperately want one, a children's museum there. 90% of the respondents said that they thought it was something that really, that Rochester greatly needed, and that in spite of the economy, that they would help support. Which is a great position to start in. So that's where we're at with that, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you. And thank you again for your generosity.
Good report.
Thank you.
Public television. Welcome back, Mr. Harmon.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Ms. Steinbach?
Yes.
And I don't have the other name.
This is Allison Pereira. And Allison is going to be operating our video team.
Very good. Hadana?
Pardon me?
Allison Hadana?
Herrera. Herrera. H-E-R-R.
We were practicing rolling our R's, and I lost.
I said I like to pronounce it properly because it gives me the opportunity to practice.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Alan Harmon. I am the general manager of WDSE-WRPT, the public television station serving northeastern Minnesota, and am here today in my role as the president of the Minnesota Public Television Association, representing the six independent entities that provide public television service to the state of Minnesota. Also presenting today is Diane Steinbach, who is Executive Director of Arts and Cultural Media for Twin Cities Public Television. We thank you for the opportunity today to update you on the report that we provided you back January 15th. And just as a brief recap, that report highlighted our focus on Minnesota artists and Minnesota heritage, anticipating using our resources to make those arts and cultural activities available not just statewide but worldwide through appropriate use of technology. We shared some early numbers indicating that we had already featured some 65 individual artists and had established collaborative efforts with dozens of arts and cultural agencies across the state. And we also shared some information about jobs, recognizing that arts and cultural heritage dollars are not and were not intended to be a job function, but in these times, feeling that jobs is important, the fact that we have created some 30 full-time equivalents using the first year of arts and cultural heritage funding to public television. In the 2 months since that report, we have continued our work with artists. We have continued to build collaborations with arts and cultural organizations statewide. But most important, our work is on the cusp of providing visible results in programs that will be ready to air shortly. So that startup investment, that startup period is beginning to bear fruit. In addition to our report on January 15th, committee members also received a document entitled Minnesota State of Innovation, a report commissioned by the legislature to develop 10-year goals and 25-year vision for use of the arts and cultural heritage dollars on January 15th. So I'd like to take just a moment before we show you some of what the programming looks like to mention the ways in which public television's involvement with arts and cultural heritage activities supports those 10-year goals. In terms of access, 99% of Minnesota households have access to the programming that we will make available through simple technology of a television. We're building engagement across Minnesota in terms of access and awareness of the arts, but also through outreach programs like Prairie Public Television's teacher institutes, encouraging direct engagement by Minnesotans. We're looking at ways of increasing collaboration. Funding from Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund has made possible actively creating new collaborative efforts. One example, WDSE-WRPT's work with the Duluth Symphony Orchestra and University of Minnesota Duluth to expand access to the DSSO's youth concert from the 2,000 seats in the Duluth Auditorium to schools available statewide. In terms of sustainability, our work will be available not only to Minnesotans but across the web to individuals anywhere in the world. And in terms of transparency, we have been keenly aware of the needs for accountability and have worked closely with the Department of Administration to develop agreements that provide the accountability that Minnesota citizens deserve and the flexibility that will allow us to creatively achieve our program objectives. We want to especially thank Kristen Batson, Alyssa Haugen, and Lenore Madigan in Department of Administration for their support and cooperation in reaching those agreements. But Minnesota's community licensed public television stations are really excited to leverage the resources that we have available, resources in part available because of the legislature's long support of our funding, not only in arts and cultural heritage funding, but in operating funding, to bring some really exciting new programming to the people of Minnesota. And for that, Diane is one of the very creative people who's in charge of making that happen, and she's going to show you some examples.
Thank you, Ms. Steinbeck.
Yes, and can you hear me okay? Okay. Does sound like I'm on. What I want to do is just recap a little bit about all of the input that we solicited over the course of the summer, working with many, many arts organizations and holding brainstorms to talk about, to ask the arts community basically for input into what kinds of programs would best serve both the state of Minnesota but also the artists. And so after all of that input, the fall was spent hiring our staffs. And I have to say that one of the most wonderful things about this legacy funding is the number of partnerships that have been created by it. I mean, we're all talking to each other. We've all collaborated in the past, but when you're sort of working from grant to grant to grant, and sometimes you get them and sometimes you don't, now we have the opportunity to work together. And this is a statewide effort. It's also been a great coalescing factor among the Minnesota Public Television Association stations, because we all operate in our own individual areas, as I'm sure all of you do, and at this point we're now all talking to each other. We've had several workshops. We've all got weekly programs that are in development. Many of them are starting to air this week. A couple of them are on the air. Most of them go on the air in April, next month. So staggered throughout this next month, you'll start to see many, many programs. And on your handout, it does list the six stations and what each station is doing. The other partnership that we've developed here locally in the Twin Cities is with the Minnesota Humanities Center, because we also wanted to have an education, an arts education component. And so we're working within our weekly programs for the Minnesota Original Project, which is here in the Twin Cities. We will have at least one segment per half-hour program. We'll have on our website a downloadable lesson guide and the video that the teachers can use in their classroom. And so that was a really important piece to us as well, that we make sure that between the broadcast of the programs, which is airing on all of our digital services, and statewide on the Minnesota channel, we will also be incorporating some of the segments that are produced in greater Minnesota by the other stations in our program. So that way we have almost this statewide, as they call it in the news business, stringers. You know, we're all working together, and we can all cover stories or artists that are working, might be working here in the Twin Cities, but are from Duluth. And so there's been this wonderful exchange of creative energy. The other thing I would like to do is thank the folks at DOA, because they really have been great. This has been such a big project, and they've been so cooperative and easy to work with, as Al said. The other thing that programs that we're producing are two documentaries, cultural documentaries and history documentaries. One has begun shooting this week, and that's going to be on Ojibwe language revitalization. And we're in research. That'll air in September. We're in research on a second one on Latino history in Minnesota. To our knowledge, there are no programs on these subjects. They're fascinating topics with lots of interesting information and historic information. So we'll be producing one each year of the biennium for broadcast as well. In our programs, we're covering all disciplines, and our focus is local artists. All of the local artists that appear in our programs, you're all familiar with television pieces, that they all have some pictures and some interviews and some music. Well, what we've decided to do, instead of buying stock music, which we often do, or finding music in music libraries, is to use the music of local musicians. So all of the music that you'll hear in this program, and we credit them after each piece, after each segment ends, we list the names of the Minnesota musicians whose music appeared in this segment. So we've been getting lots of positive feedback and rights clearances as well, because musicians are so excited about having their music have, you know, another venue and more opportunity for promotion. We're covering all disciplines. We have an advisory committee with people of that represent each discipline in the arts, so that we can get feedback from them periodically throughout the process. Also call on them sometimes for fact-checking information if, in case we're working in a history area or an art history area. So it's really been just an outstanding experience so far, and we're all anxious to hit the air and share it with our individual publics. What you'll see in just a second is a sampler, because with six stations, we really wanted to keep our time and be respectful of your time. And rather than show you programs, of course, which we don't have time for, this is just a little smattering of what each station is doing, some visuals and some explanation of how they're using their legacy funding. So let's take a look.
With a relatively small investment, the programming on the Minnesota Public Television stations can really make a big difference.
What's the beating heart of Minnesota?
To travel down those country roads, to tell those stories.
If I had a camera, I would try to contact all the little towns that have a theater.
More about the history of the different counties.
We get the ooh-ah factor with the kids.
I think everyone can benefit from having art in their lives.
An abstract painter years ago, but what I discovered was they didn't make me happy. What made me happy was realism. I'm creating something.
I started clay when I was a little kid. My dad used to have a pottery studio here, and we made all these bird feeders and different things. Clay likes to flow like mud or water, or it flows through your fingers to go up to make a vessel.
The Jefferson Highway was a main highway running all the way from Louisiana to Winnipeg, but it was the main highway through this part of the country. This is part of history, and I really enjoy saving some of that.
I guess the Rosemary is one way for me to show that I am Norwegian, I'm proud of it, and when I'm painting it, it just reminds me so much of the whole connection with family.
Being around more creative work has made me feel more, enlivened, I guess I would say. And so the idea that having Playlist, where the art of the community, the music, the theater, the visuals, the people, and having that be even more familiar makes that better.
Thank you so much, everybody. Take care.
And I must have 200 poems. I don't know, what the keepers are, poems that would be of interest to other people and are worth reading more than once. But you never know. When you do this, you work at them for a while, and then you leave them sit, and you sort of like fermenting corn mash, and you wait and see what happens.
And I'm a Minnesota original.
on and the words don't come.
I'm just trying to make the music I can be proud of and play for people, and hopefully it touches people the way that my favorite musicians touch me.
Remember that education is the most powerful weapon you can use.
The idea behind this program is that young people have and need a voice.
You call this acting white.
Using the creative process and theater methods, the arts becomes a vehicle for their voice to be in the world.
Mostly landscapes. I work from nature. That can be a big vista, and that can be like this small little intimate thing. That's what's fun, is I'm never quite sure what that's going to be.
It's not just about sit down, be quiet, the lights are going off, clap your hands and leave. It's more of a dialogue, and the audience is as important to what we do as what's going on stage.
We're on TV.
You enough. As you can see, we will never run out of material. And we've had a great day.
For sure. Yeah. But how to pick the right things?
Well,
you'll just have to keep trying and trying and trying.
We're looking for really good stories that where artists can just be, they're citizens of Minnesota who pay taxes like the rest of us, and do creative work for a living. They are small business people. And there's so much just in new communities, new ethnic communities in Minnesota. And, there's just so much good work going on and people who are able to talk about it. And we thought it would make the arts much more accessible if people could go behind the scenes and hear in the artist's own words, learn more about their process and what they go through, that they're people with real training and a real gift, and that way it starts to break down some of the stereotypes that people have had about artists. So that's our hope, and using the power of public television, as we always say, we'll cover the entire state and introduce people in greater Minnesota to cities artists and vice versa. I mean, because we're all interconnected, and so we'll learn about people from all over the state who are doing great work.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Representative Laughlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I think we should applaud the work of many of these stations in terms of doing our vision of kind of cross-fertilizing, you know, whether it's a program about the local state parks or historic sites within their community. Mm-hmm. If I look through all of these, almost all of them mention their local historical society. They mention local galleries, local artists. They have, you know, a real local flavor, but it also is history, culture, arts all together. I have to say, though, the one that stands out that doesn't is mine, which is Twin Cities Public Television, and I really hope that you will, in addition to meeting the statewide needs, really focus on the Twin Cities and the wonderful opportunities that it has to highlight its own unique history. And if there's a need for telling statewide stories, that maybe the group should get together and set aside a certain amount for stories that belong to all of us, or productions that should feature things from throughout the whole state of Minnesota. Because when I read your descriptions, they always talk about Minnesota artists. It doesn't talk about Twin Cities artists. And
our program will be.
And so I'm just saying, I don't see the same flavor. I don't see you talking about the local communities in the same way that the others do. Mm-hmm. And I can't wait to look forward to seeing all the little hidden gems throughout the Seven County metro area being brought to life in the same way that Greater Minnesota has stepped up.
Yeah, our focus is completely Twin Cities. What we'll do is share within our program some of the projects that are being produced with artists out in the state. But every station is producing local stories and reaching out to their local artists and local historical society.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We look forward to seeing all of these.
Thank you. Tune in.
Yes. On various stations 1 and 2 and 3 and 4. I've gotten so I know how to do that now, Mr. Harmon. Know how to get, if I don't like what's on one, I can switch to the next.
That's why we offer more than one then.
Yes. That's a good thing. The Science Museum, Ms. Rainey, but welcome back.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. It's nice to be back. It's nice to have this opportunity to come in and say thank you for the appropriation we received last year and to share information about what we're doing with that money. The Science Museum was very grateful for the appropriation of $900,000 over the course of the biennium. And our senior management team got together and came up with some criteria that they wanted to use to guide the use of that money. And we also took criteria from this subcommittee and looked at what are the projects that are going to best use and best reflect the intent of the voters when they voted to tax themselves and raise this funding. So we decided that we wanted to do a few key things. One, improve our collection of artifacts representing Minnesota's cultural heritage. Two, create deeper and broader connections with our work with residents across the state of Minnesota. And inspire even more enthusiasm in Minnesota for science and its social and cultural impacts in the past, in the present, and in the future. So I'm going to talk about three projects that we are working on with the legacy funding and talk about how they are addressing some of the criteria that that this committee and our senior leadership devised. So the first one that I'll talk about is American Indian artifact acquisition. We were very excited on January 28th of this year to close a purchase of a 191-piece collection of American Indian artifacts, and we've been working on that purchase for several months, and it was wonderful to finally sign all of the paperwork and have that done. This collection consists primarily of items from regional Dakota and Ojibwe tribes. Those objects in this collection are anthropological tools which aid in contextualizing the experience of American Indians locally, nationally, and regionally. The items are primarily from the years 1830 to 1910, and Representative Erdahl can tell you far more than I can about the impact of that time frame and the importance of those items. I think that the real value in the collection, though, is more than just the scholarly value or the individual rareness of the items. I think it's really in the fact that without the museum being able to purchase this collection using legacy funds, which we probably wouldn't have been able to do without the legacy dollars, the chances of this this collection being broken up and sold off to the highest bidder from who knows where across the country or across the world, that chance was pretty high. So we were able to save this collection, keep it in Minnesota where it belongs, and maintain it in perpetuity for the public.
Where do you find a collection like that, Ms. Rainey?
This collection was actually, it was existing in our building. We had been, it had been on a long-term loan to us from Shattuck St. Mary's School, who was the owner. And they had contracted with us several years ago and said, we don't have the capacity or the expertise to take care of these things. Will you do that? And we did. And then they decided that they needed to sell the collection, and at that point it may have gone somewhere else, and we were able to go ahead and purchase it. And like I said, we probably wouldn't have had the funding to do that without the legacy dollars. So that was, in our opinion, an excellent use of the money. And there is an economic impact to purchasing that collection by having those in our ownership right now. as opposed to just on a long-term loan. It's opened up a lot of interest from private donors and from foundations to help us fund programming and other activities using the objects in the collection. They may have been a little bit hesitant to do that before, not knowing if they could at any moment in time suddenly no longer be here. Now they know they're here, and there's a lot of interest in capitalizing on that. And we're also in preliminary conversations with some other agencies and other institutions about doing collaborative programming, using the objects and really using them to their full extent. And I think that meets one of the goals that this committee had in terms of leveraging state money with collaborations. So we're hoping to do some of that. Another project that we're working on is a traveling program and object-based community development exhibit. And what we're doing is we've identified five Greater Minnesota communities, and those are Duluth, Mankato, Moorhead, Rochester, and St. Cloud. And we'll be working in those communities as well as in the metro area, working with community members to explore site-specific, culturally meaningful ways to connect culture, science, and community using the objects and the stories that they bring to us. And I'll just use an example because this might sound a little esoteric at this point. But for example, perhaps in Moorhead, a person might come in with some objects from a flood in the Red River Valley, objects that they salvaged from that flood. And they'll have stories from their own experience with that flood. Other community members might as well. And what our exhibit development staff will do is create things like a theater piece around the experience of that flood, talking about why was the flood of, you know, year whatever so bad? What was the science behind that? How did the flood impact the future of the valley? And then what are the stories that people can remember and have passed down and live on in their own personal culture and their community culture about that shared experience? I don't know if anyone on the committee has had the opportunity to see the theater production we did in conjunction with the race exhibit a few years ago, but I think it was a really skillful way of weaving a lot of different information into a story that people left after having a pretty compelling experience watching it. So it'll be something like that, along with objects and vitrines that you might be more used to associating with an exhibit, interpretive material that's been collected. But it's going to be very community driven, and we're really excited about doing that. Because of this project, we have hired some part-time staff. Five staff members have had an additional about 10 hours a week of work, and that work is expected to continue throughout the course of the biennium. So we are always keeping an eye on job creation and job retention. We also contracted an artistic director, so that, well, not a full-time position, is definitely additional work for that person. And we're going to be presenting these theater pieces and exhibits in the communities from which they spring, potentially creating new audiences for community resources that people might not otherwise be using. And we're really excited about collaborating with those organizations in that way. There's also a strong evaluation component to that project. We are fortunate enough at the Science Museum to have an in-house evaluation team, and we're certainly going to be using their expertise evaluating a pilot project that we have slated for June of 2010 here in St. Paul. We're going to do evaluation on the workshop structure that creates the program attendance, and then visitor use of the exhibition components. And then we'll apply that research and that evaluation into the community work we do in the greater Minnesota areas. And subsequent evaluation will continue to be done in each community so that we can continue to learn and refine and improve our process. The last project that we're working on with Legacy Dollars is a video conferencing solution to some of our decline in our field trip attendance. And in December, we brought in a national expert on video conferencing in informal education sites, and she had a great degree of program and technical knowledge that she shared with us after evaluating our site and our programs and whatnot. And then we coupled that knowledge with our own pedagogical expertise, and people in our education division have been working on creating a program a cultural heritage program that will be aimed at students in greater Minnesota. And the topic for the first program that we're going to pilot is going to address the new Minnesota Academic Science Standard, and I'm going to read it, about men and women from all cultures, including Minnesota American Indian tribes and communities, having been involved in engineering design and scientific inquiry. That's a new standard in the Minnesota Science Standards. But we think we're really uniquely positioned to take something like a birch canoe from our American Indian collection and have one of our scientists go through and explain how this was created, how it was used, why it might even be better than some of the canoes that are being produced now, how all of those types of things in a much more compelling way for a student. And they don't have to come to the museum to experience this. They're going to be able to experience this in their classroom. We understand the pressures that teachers are under with high-stakes testing and whatnot, and so we're going to be very careful to make sure that all of our programs do tie directly to state standards so that a teacher doesn't feel like they have to take time away from that in order to give kids a different experience. And obviously, based on our experience with that first program, we're hoping to expand that to multiple programs with multiple topics, again, all relating back to standards. There will be an economic impact with this project as well. We'll probably be hiring another staff person, a part-time person, but about 20 hours a week of work to keep this project moving on a steady and timely way. And again, we'll be using our in-house evaluation team. We're already conducting audience surveys to identify factors like what time of the day should this be offered, how long should it be, what are the grade ranges that are most important, really talking to teachers and finding out what is it that you want on the front end so that we don't design something and find out it's not going to be very worthwhile. We've also convened an advisory committee of teachers, principals, and school district technology coordinators to evaluate the relevancy and the value of our programming structure. What we've learned is that the school districts are way ahead of us in terms of the technology, and we're actually going to learn from them and play catch up with them because they're really the experts in that field. And then as we're going through with the programming and as schools sign up and receive the distance learning opportunities, we'll be doing evaluation with the teachers, with the students, with our own staff, and again, constantly refining and improving the programs that we offer. So those are the three programs that we are planning and that we're working on right now. In a few more months, we'll have a lot more information to share. And again, I want to thank the committee for apportioning some of those legacy dollars to the Science Museum. We think we're being good stewards of that money. We're very excited about the projects that we're doing, and we really think they embody the intent the voters had when they made that decision in November of 2008. But I do want to encourage you not to just take my word for it, but to come down and to check us out and to see the programs in action and to see them in your own communities when they're able to travel there. If you're ever interested in seeing any of these things up close and personal, please let me know.
We will do that. This sounds like an exciting beginning.
We're very excited.
Questions? Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Purpose Center for the Arts. Pam Paulson and Susan Mackart.
Hello, yes. Madam Chair, members of the Cultural and Outdoor Resources Finance Division, it's a pleasure for me to be here today as the Executive Director of the Purpose Center for Arts Education. The Purpose Center was invited to further influence the future direction of Minnesota's K-12 students by participating in a special project by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. As a state agency for arts education, we welcomed the challenge and took it very seriously. We listened to legislators and other leaders voice their desire to have the Purpose Center's assistance for investing arts education funds from the constitutional amendment for a systemic, long-term impact for all Minnesota students. We observed their keen sensitivity to the role of arts education in our schools and the resulting effects on student learning, achievement, and equity. And then we rolled up our sleeves and went to work. The project we designed, with major support from the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, allows us to piggyback on our 25-year heritage of excellence in arts education. It does not supplant, nor does it cover existing gaps in arts education felt by school districts. Rather, we are spearheading an interdisciplinary approach to teaching and learning, creating a culture within schools and school districts that increases student learning in and through the arts. The legislature granted us $1 million from the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, $300,000 for fiscal year 2010, and $700,000 in fiscal year 2011. Today, Dr. Pamela Paulson, Senior Director of Policy at the Perpich Center, will share with you a synopsis of our direction and progress. But before I let her do that, I would just like to conclude by simply stating that we understand and respect the difficult role you play in overseeing the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Despite what some may believe, giving money away isn't always easy. We also respect the wishes of the Minnesota voters. Creating a legacy requires impeccable planning, forthright communication and integrity in decision making, a strong spirit of collaboration, adherence to mission, and effective stewardship of taxpayer dollars. These are the principles under which the Perpich Center is operating. We are proud to be partners with you in creating a legacy in arts education that will propel Minnesota students as skilled, productive citizens of the 21st century. Following Dr. Paulson's presentation, I'd be happy to respond to any questions, and with that, I will turn it over to Pamela.
Thank you, Sue. Thank you, Ms. Paulson. Madam Chair, members of the committee, we are very, very pleased to be here this evening with you. And before coming, we read the guidelines and principles as we've been working on our projects. And we are very excited to see the language that's being used in your principles and guidelines. Here's a quote from one of the principals saying that the priority should be given to investments in arts, history, music, and cultural activities that demonstrably help student achievement in schools. That makes our heart sing. An outcome that's listed in that same document is an increased number of K-12 students who can affordably learn to read music and play a musical instrument, participate in dance, choral, drama, and other performing arts for which financial barriers can limit access to this educational experience. Again, a very profound statement. And we know that this fund is an opportunity for all children. And I just thought I had to look up the word legacy to see how it was being defined by Webster after I was digging into all of the language that we were using. And it's a gift, something received from an ancestor or a predecessor or something from the past. So I think of arts education as a gift for the future of Minnesota, because, and I know you captured it in the first quote that I just read about schools being a key place. If you really want to have equal access to the children of Minnesota, schools are a great place to do that because all the kids are in school and they have access that isn't a cost barrier to be able to study the arts. And of course, schools in many communities are actually the hub of the community, social hub, educational hub. It's a wonderful opportunity. The Perpich Center for Arts Education wants to help achieve the outcomes that you've identified, and we feel like we can jump into this with you because we are prepared with a lot of tools that we have developed over the last 25 years to design really excellent programming in arts education. We have expertise and connections all across the state and across the nation, actually. There are many states that look to Minnesota for best practices in arts education, and now they're looking at us because of this constitutional amendment, and it is an astounding opportunity. We also have a focus on student learning, but it is through teacher development, and that's an important piece of our work. We were lucky to partner with the Department of Education this year and do a staff, be part of their staff development survey. We had four questions in there, and we're happy because it is the first opportunity to collect some data on arts education and professional development. And we found in this first survey that schools overwhelmingly want the Purpich Center to provide assistance in professional development for teachers who are interested in doing more work in and through the arts. And we're really excited to know that there is a big demand out there for this new work that we're undertaking in arts integration. So it is not just arts teachers. It is teachers from a variety of subject areas, as well as artists, that need professional development in the arts to really help students achieve the learning expectations. And in our state, we are lucky again to have academic standards in the arts. And our standards include a lot of the very language you used in the principles that were developed for this committee's work. We are about having students learn how to create artworks, new artworks in their own voice. We're about helping students learn how to present and perform their work, not always in fancy and huge big venues, but often in intimate settings where they can try out new work that isn't necessarily a reproduction of somebody else's work, but newly created voices of their own. One of our standards has to do with responding to performances and exhibitions as active audience members. We want to help create the audiences of the future. And of course, we want them to know something about historical and cultural context. We established an advisory group that is helping us achieve these outcomes, and it is represented by all of the folks on this screen, Department of Ed, U of M, and not just one department at the University of Minnesota, but we've got dance and theater and visual arts and music represented, College of Visual Arts, a senator, the Improved Research Group. We've got a professional organizations, the public schools, charter schools. St. Cloud State University's dean is a part of this, and elementary and secondary principals, Parents United, and the Lake Country Service Cooperative. So we have designed two projects that we're extremely happy with the opportunity to dig into and work on. And one is this arts integration project, where we're going to combine the arts with other subject areas, so we're going to be able to work with teachers across the curriculum. And the second is a research study. It's called the Arts Education in Minnesota Schools Research Project. And I think you'll be happy to know that we will be collecting information, data about arts education, which has never been collected in the state of Minnesota before. And not only are we going to collect information about the status of arts education, but we are going to include an arts integration piece. So let me start with just talking about the Arts Integration Pilot Project, which will happen in a northern region of the state with rural communities. We are going to establish educator networks within this region for artists and for teacher professional development around arts integration. Secondly, we want to demonstrate and document different models of arts integration, and then hopefully this program can grow, and we will be able to share these opportunities, these models, these different ways that schools have tackled this with more schools. And finally, we want to connect and align the resources in the region, which calls for collaborations. And in order to connect and align the resources, collaborations will be required with schools and community resources to bring to bear for the best learning opportunities for the students, including libraries, who can collaborate with our Purpich Center statewide library. And our library on the campus at the Purpich Center in Golden Valley has a wonderful library that has a lot of unique arts education pieces in the collection. So as far as the Arts Integration Project goes, we've already done some initial work to figure out what's going on in our state in arts in arts integration, and we have found from teacher groups that were involved in these focus groups there are 9 benefits, and we'll go backwards. The first one is that generally communities that support the arts, the teachers believed, also support arts integration. They tell us that planning is absolutely necessary. They have to have time to come together, share their standards, talk about what the kids are supposed to learn, and plan together. And it can be done with all subject areas. You name it, really. The teachers felt like they could find an authentic connection. It does require a budget. And partners between the subject matter teacher and the arts specialist help make this more successful. students are more engaged in the learning and stay in school if they're more engaged and want to come to school. Arts integration allows students to use multiple learning modalities, so maybe they're a visual learner, maybe they're an auditory learner, music, dance. We know, really, kids are very kinesthetic for a long time, and they don't want to sit in their seats like we have to do often during the day. They told us, the teachers told us, that academic standards are very important for the successful integration of the arts across the curriculum, and they told us that arts integration results in more student learning. So now let's take just a quick look at the second of the projects. And this one's an overview of the Arts Education in Minnesota Schools Research Project. For that, there's really two purposes. And the first is to collect this baseline data that we have never collected in Minnesota before that will give us a picture of all the kids in public schools, private schools, charter schools, so that we know, because we don't know this for sure right now, which schools are offering which art areas, which schools are requiring all kids to meet the expectations that are laid out in statute for arts education. How much time are they spending in these arts classes? Are they really attending to the standards? Who are their teachers? And get this whole picture laid out for us. And then we'll be collaborating with the Department of Education, we already are, to continue trying to gather data so that this picture evolves over time. And that leads to the second one, which is we then can evaluate the needs that are out there and do a better job of determining the programming. It has three parts. The Arts Integration Pilot Study is the one that we started to gather data about the focus groups. We'll also do a survey on this. And the really wonderful thing is that this pilot then will be able to be used when we do the third part, which is this arts comprehensive statewide census. And in the middle, there's an effort to get some information on existing programming and do a little bit of a program evaluation of some of the arts education programs that we've been doing. You've put us in a tight timeline, and we have responded by jumping into action and feeling very energized by this opportunity. From October to January, we began gathering the existing resources that are out there from various state agencies and our own and our partners and our professional organizations. We have begun this arts integration pilot study that I just mentioned. We've convened our advisory group. We just finished, the board just approved the RFPs to hire some facilitators and planners for the arts integration project. And we are planning soon. We'll begin that in April. We are developing a selection process for the schools in that northern district that we're going to region that we're going to work with. In May, we want to invite them so they know who they are before the end of the school year and they can be ready partners with us in the fall. We plan to hire a program evaluator that can help us learn from the implementation about what is most effective. We will implement the arts integration program in the schools starting in the fall and carrying through the rest of that school year. And finally, we'll also do this big statewide census, including the arts integration component, between October of next year and December of 11. And then finally, next steps, we would really like to be partners in increasing access, equity, and quantity of arts education in Minnesota by hopefully being able to expand this pilot project from just one region to several, many regions in the state, and eventually probably all. And we'd like to offer more teachers of various subject areas professional development in the arts to help more students achieve. And then finally, we want to share the power of arts and culture in our lives and in our kids' lives. So we say thank you to you. You've got an enormous task that we're so grateful for your leadership for cultural and outdoor resources. Any questions?
Ms. Mackert, when you applied for the position, did you know that this was part of it?
I was volunteering at the time when this was surfacing. I was primarily working to help gather the full agency together in agency status. So this was just an added bonus, I guess I would have to say, among other things.
Good choice of words. Chair. An added bonus.
Very good.
Questions, comments? Sounds ambitious and quite, from my experience, needed. Thank you. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm glad you're stepping up to a difficult challenge. I was contacted by an artist in my community after the Arts Action Day, and she suggested that we pay more attention to the after-school and summer activities for arts education as well, and I'm hoping as you survey that you might answer some of those questions as well.
Madam Chair, Madam Chair, Representative, that is one of the primary reasons we asked and have received new windows that we will be putting in our residence hall, because we know that there's extreme need and desire for after school as well as summer programs, significant summer programs for both students and teachers. So we hope to meet those growing needs and demands. Thank you for asking.
And Madam Chair and Representative Loeffler, we also are including questions about that in the survey, so we'll know what's going on for both in school, after school, which is co-curricular and extracurricular activities.
And thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Jens, Minnesota Arts Board.
Any help. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sue Jens. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Arts Board, and it's a pleasure to be with you again today. And I appreciate the opportunity to give you some highlights of the report that you all should have received from us on the 1st of March. It's quite long and quite detailed, and I promise you, given the hour, I won't go page by page, but there are some things in it that I wanted to point out for you, and also to leave some questions at the end, or time for questions at the end, if you have them. The report is long because when we were here about a year ago, during the last legislative session, we talked to you a great deal about the strength of our process. We talked to you a great deal about the strength of our statewide citizen-driven system. We talked to you a great deal about the strength of our cultural and creative community. We didn't talk to you a great deal about the details of how the money would be spent that you had entrusted to us. And so that's why we've given you quite a bit of detail in the report that you have in front of you. The first five pages, I believe I have shared with you in the past. It's an overview of the sort of where all of this started. And then it's some of our guiding documents that we at the Arts Board, working in Congress with the 11 regional arts councils, have developed. We created for ourselves a 25-year vision, and if you have the report in front of you, it's on page 3. We mean that to be our inspiration as we move forward. What is it that we'd like to accomplish, and what is it that we want for Minnesota as a result of these new funds that are now available? We talk about the role we want the arts to play in people's lives, in our economy, in our educational system, and as an identifier, something that makes Minnesota stand out amongst all of the other states. So that's what we will collectively be working on over the 25 years. Pages 4 and 5, I know I've shared those with you before as well. Those are our guiding principles. We have 7 principles. They're quite simple, and in many ways they mirror the principles that you have set out for yourselves as a committee, to be looking statewide, to be fair about the demography and the geographic sections of the state. We want to be comprehensive, to think about all of the arts, not just the arts that we have today, but what will the arts look like in 10 years or 25 years. We also want to look ahead, to be flexible as much as we can. We want to be transparent and have public involvement. That's always been one of our strengths. And we want to be the best stewards we can for these dollars. Page 5 are the goals and key strategies we've set for ourselves, starting with an overarching goal that we want everyone to understand that the arts are essential to a vibrant society. They can influence so much of our individual lives, our community lives, our collective lives as a state and a culture. And so there are a variety of ways that we've laid out for ourselves and a variety of strategies. We don't have them in any particular order. So these are all the things that we thought we needed to work together to try to accomplish. The remainder of the report really is the detail, the spending detail. Pages 6 through 11 are Arts Board. programs and services that we have designed. Just to refresh your memory, you'll recall that approximately $43.3 million of the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund was entrusted to the Arts Board and to the 11 Regional Arts Councils, about 46% of the overall fund. And of that, you directed us to have the Regional Arts Councils manage 30% of the funds, and the Arts Board would manage 70% of the funds. So you have on pages 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11, seven brand new grant programs that we've put in place. And these are really meant to do three things. One is that they're meant to sustain the artists and arts organizations who are so valuable to Minnesota. If you will permit me a really lousy metaphor, if you think about the goose that laid the golden egg, it's really our job to keep the goose alive and healthy and productive and nourished. It was great to see the public television videotape, because there are so many artists and arts organizations with whom we work and who rely on us for funding so that they can do their work, so that they can expand their careers and their artistic development. So it was wonderful to see that. Another thing that we're trying to do with our funding is to make more arts activities available throughout the state of Minnesota. And so you see we're providing funding for touring, to move things around the state of Minnesota so that depending, you aren't necessarily bound by geography, so that you will have a chance to access some of the other kinds of arts programs that are available. We're also developing two programs that will try to specifically target underserved populations and to bring people who would like to have opportunities to be involved in the arts into those activities in a more strategic and organic way. We are the Arts Learning or Arts Education Funds that we had in the past were specifically focused on schools. We'll continue to make those available, but we've also really broadened our program now. We call it Arts Learning broadly, and whether one is 3 years old or 83 years old, we'd like there to be opportunities to learn to play the violin, to learn to paint, to take a writing class. And so our program is quite broad and can be available for just a full range of kinds of arts activities. We also intend to provide operating support for community arts schools. These, again, are places where you don't have to be a professional artist. You just have to have a love of learning and want to try something. It's the sort of place where the 8-year-old sits next to the 80-year-old in the recital, and they learn from each other and they share the joy of making art together. And finally, we have three new programs that will be coming out of the cultural heritage part of the funding that you've appropriated for us. Investing in our folk and traditional artists, investing in festivals that celebrate those kinds of arts, and we're also hoping to work with a partner to put together a touring exhibition that will take folk arts, primarily visual arts, but perhaps also performing arts, throughout the state next fiscal year in fiscal year 11. So that's very quickly an overview of the new things that we will be doing with Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund dollars. We've also used some of our dollars to supplement some of our existing programs, knowing that we have been underfunded in some key areas, and so we've used some of the dollars to do that. We are on, at the beginning of the summer, I believe all agencies, maybe not all, were asked to create a spending plan for the legacy dollars. And in ours, because of the size of the appropriations that you'd awarded us, we were advised to delay funding. So our programs and the regional arts programs really are just now getting started. We had February deadlines in all of these grant programs. We'll review those applications in April, and in May our board will approve the bulk of the grants that you see in these grant programs. So we hope before the end of the session we can come back to you and give you a very long list of grantees.
How were you asked for that spending plan?
Madam Chair, that came from Minnesota Management and Budget.
In what form?
I don't recall if it was a phone call or if it was a memo, but we were asked to provide a spending plan for the Arts Board, and each of the Regional Arts Councils were also asked to provide a spending plan, and that was reviewed by Minnesota Management and Budget, and it was adjusted a little. And then it was approved, and that's the plan that we're using.
Do you have the approval? Was the approval in writing?
Madam Chair, other than an email that says the plan meets our needs, I mean, there was not a sort of a formal contract, but we were working with our executive budget officer, who was very helpful in helping us make the plan work for them and work for us as well as we possibly could.
And the budget officer is?
It's Mr. Baumtrog.
Okay.
Is our budget officer. Okay. And he's been very helpful.
Is he here? He's ours. He's all of ours.
He's wonderful. He's been very helpful. The bulk, then, of the report, starting on pages 12 through the end, do similar kinds of things. They give you information about the kinds of programs that each of the 11 regional arts councils is planning to invest in. And again, I, because of the number of pages, I won't go through all of them, but I'll give you some overviews or some highlights. Regional Arts Council grants go out as block grants. The Minnesota State Arts Board does not control those. Regions have the charge of designing programs and services and activities that are best suited to meet the needs of their communities and their residents. The local boards have final decision-making authority over those dollars. So those go out to the regions in that way. You see the breakdown of the dollars by region on page 13 against those three categories as well. And because of the spending plan, we've made two of three payments to the Regional Arts Council, so they have received approximately 25% of their appropriated funds, and the balance will be paid to the Regional Arts Councils in April. A few common characteristics or a few common priorities that you would see as you look across these pages. A number of the regional arts councils have decided to take a comprehensive approach, to say that we will have a grant program called our Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund grant program. Any individual or artist, arts organization that would like to apply, school, community center, nonprofit, would all come into one program. And so you'll see that across several of the regions, that that's a common strategy. You'll see that a number of the regions are also providing funds to students, directly to students, either as scholarships or as mentorships. Ways that perhaps high school students can work with an artist one-on-one to develop his or her talent. So you'll see that in several of the regions as well. A number of the regions decided that they wanted to invest in public art in their regions, that they wanted to be able to place either commissioned or purchased works of art in their communities or in neighborhoods throughout their region. So you'll see new programs in several of the regions that do that. One of the programs that you will see across all of the regions is professional development for artists and arts organizations. Back to my really poor metaphor of the goose that laid the golden egg, we want to continually invest in the capacity and the skill and the development of our artists and arts organizations. And in many cases, we will be working collaboratively with the regional arts councils to do some of those programs so that there is some benefit of efficiency. There were just a couple of programs that I wanted to point out because they're quite different than others. And if you'll indulge me, on page 19, you'll see that in the region 2, which is the sort of Bemidji area and then straight north of there, they're doing something called an Arts Legacy Designation Grant Program. And those are grants actually to cities and counties or townships that incorporate the arts into those public agencies or into those communities. Interesting approach. We'll be watching that to see how successful it is and what kind of projects come out of that. Region 5 on page 29 has a program that invests in the staffs and the boards and the volunteers of nonprofit organizations. Especially in Greater Minnesota, there are a great deal of volunteer-driven organizations, and so it's an investment in the leadership of those organizations. Region 10 is doing a program for small towns and rural communities. The grantees must be communities with less than 7,500 people in them. Again, a real incubator kind of project. And finally, in Region 11 here in the Twin Cities, there is a new program that will invest in ADA improvements for arts organizations. So if you're an arts organization that has repurposed a school building or a church and it doesn't have a ramp or it doesn't have an elevator or it doesn't have handicapped seating, you can get a small grant to do that. Like the Arts Board, most of the regional arts councils have their grant deadlines happening now, and they will be completing those grant rounds by the end of this fiscal year as well. So I've just gone very quickly through the report. I hope you'll have a chance to look at it more in depth, and I'd be happy to answer individual questions at another time. But for today, I just wanted to say that There have been a number of really important milestone moments in the arts in Minnesota. One of them was in 1903 when we were one of the first states to create a state arts agency for the arts. Another one was in the 1970s when we created this decentralized system, so we have statewide needs being met at the statewide level and local needs being met at the regional level. And then the most recent milestone really was November of 2008 when Minnesotans said that they were so committed to their natural and cultural resources that they were willing to increase their taxes, to increase the state's investment in those. In many ways, that campaign and that vote was the end of a journey but the beginning of a dream for many in the arts many in the arts community. That new commitment to the arts and writing the arts into the Constitution in Minnesota has really generated an enthusiasm and an energy and a passion that is unlike anything I've seen in the 2.5 decades that I've been working in the arts. But it's not just in the arts. We're getting phone calls from hospitals, and we're getting calls from parks and rec programs, and we're getting phone calls from ethnic cultural centers and boys and girls clubs and historical societies and schools and state parks. There's just a great deal of enthusiasm for what might be possible because of this new funding. So we're grateful to the legislature for entrusting us with the stewardship of these dollars. We hope that the plans and the framework make sense to you, and we'll look forward to sharing good news with you in the spring when we've awarded our grants, and more importantly, we'll look forward to inviting you to participate in those activities once they have begun. We'll want you to come and visit them and engage with them and with your constituents who are taking part in them. I appreciate your time today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions, and if you have any specifics about the regional arts councils that I can't answer, my colleague Jeff Prower, who is the president of the Forum of Regional Arts Councils, is here as well. And I might hand some off to him if you have questions I'm not able to answer.
A Forum of Arts Council?
It's called the Forum of Regional Arts Councils, Madam Chair. It basically is the informal structure that all 11 regional arts councils participate in. It's a process that they used for group decision making and for sharing best practices.
And we just had a couple weeks ago the Arts Day, which you were part of, and I've never seen the advocates as excited to tell us about what they were doing and new energy within them. And I think each of us got our own regional breakdown of how the arts money was spent. But does the criteria that one has to meet to receive a grant, either from the Arts Board or from the Regional Arts Council, of which they're a member, that they're applying for, is that criteria readily available to anyone?
Madam Chair, in general, it would be available on either our website for our programs, or each of the Regional Arts Councils also uses their website as a principal communication tool. And so in our case, we issue, along with the application forms, we have instructions for how to fill out those forms, and the criteria that will be used to make the decisions are printed there. The other thing that I failed to mention, but I hope that you noticed as you looked at some of the program descriptions, in each case there is a distinct goal that's been identified for the grant program, and there are outcomes. And we are asking applicants to describe in their application forms how they intend to achieve those outcomes so that we will be able to come back to you and say, these are the things that we see being accomplished with the funds.
Was in the criteria from the Arts Board to receive an Arts Board grant, was there anything that stated that they could not apply for?
Madam Chair, I'm not quite sure I'm following your question.
I'm thinking, could someone apply for a building? Or could does someone have to apply for programming or an artist's scholarship kind of thing?
Sure. Madam Chair, each of the grant programs, I think I speak for the Regional Arts Councils as well, each of the grant programs tries to be specific about the kinds of activities that it will fund and give some examples or some list of things that perhaps are not to be included in a proposal, and we did that with ours. At the Arts Board, we have a restriction that says no more than $5,000 of any of our grants can be spent on equipment, capital campaigns, anything that would be considered a capital investment. Our goal is to provide funding for activities rather than for infrastructure, the sort of bricks and mortar infrastructure. Regional arts councils, some of them have small capital grants as well, but generally it is a small grant. It wouldn't be an entire new building. And we did agree as a system that we didn't want the funds to be used to build new buildings. But if there were small equipment grants, or in the case of the ADA grant, where some small amount of money could make a significant difference to access for Minnesotans, that we wanted that to be possible.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Jens. I know we gave you a lot to do really fast, and that's always hard work. But I think it was on your website that I had noticed that schools in greater Minnesota could apply for arts touring resources, and I looked at who was eligible to do the touring in terms of the recommended groups, and they were almost all based in Minneapolis and St. Paul. And I'm wondering, is there going to be another round where Metro can get either those groups or groups from other parts of the state to tour in this direction so that it really is a true circulation across the state?
Ms. Jens.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, I'm not exactly sure which specific program you're applying to, which one you're referring. I'm wondering if it might be the Arts Learning Program, which is more designed for lifelong learning, and schools are more likely to apply to that one. The Arts Tour Program is meant to bring professional artists into a community in sort of a presenter setting. There can be additional educational activities that would be a part of that, but the purpose of that really is to bring the Commonwealth Theater out of Lanesboro and have them perform in Willmar, or to bring the Duluth Superior Symphony out of Duluth and to have them perform in Marshall, and to move artists or arts organizations around the state in that way. We did have a list of, I won't call them preferred, but we did have a list of artists and arts organizations for which the application process was a little streamlined. And it's simply because those were artists or arts organizations whose work we had had a chance to review recently. We had done so as late as last June. And so we didn't feel the need to have them send us work samples a second time and to review that work over again. And so that's possibly the list that you're referring to. Many of them are Metro, but not all of them are Metro. The list included Arts Board grantees and Regional Arts Council grantees so that we could have a broader list.
Thank you, Ms. Jens and Madam Chair. My concern was just to make sure that all parts of the state had access to an opportunity, whether it was from someone local. I mean, quite honestly, most people in the metro area have never seen Heart of the Beast or some of the other groups that are listed there. I'm sure they'd appreciate a chance to see some of the greater Minnesota talent as well.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, we share that goal. We really hope that that will also be, as this touring program is more well known and more organizations take advantage of it, we really want to see a lot of crossover throughout the state.
Representative Matt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a question trying to kind of decipher, how does an artist know in the community if their project, if they should be applying for a grant from the Regional Art Council that they're a part of, or if they should be applying to the State Arts Board? I was looking on the State Arts Board website and saw some of the grants that were given out in 2009 and that looked like they were from the State Arts Board. And so I'm just trying to figure out, how does an artist know which kind of grant is supposed to come from where, and how do they access that information?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Representative Mack, at the moment, artists often can look at both and decide which of the grant programs will be a better match for their particular project and a better match for their needs at the moment. Often, regional arts councils are making smaller grants. Arts board grants tend to be based on an opportunity. So it has to be a career opportunity or an artistic opportunity. So our grants are a little bit different than Regional Arts Council grants, many of which tend to be awards or fellowships. And we always work with artists, as do Regional Arts Councils, to help them find the best match between the two.
Ms. Knapp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so can they apply for both and wait and see which one they get, or do they have to select either State Arts Board or Regional Council, or can they put applications in for both?
Ms. Jens.
Madam Chair, Representative Mack, there are a number of programs in which they could apply for both. they could receive a Regional Arts Council grant and they could apply for a specific grant from the Arts Board. For example, Arts Tour and Arts Learning, the two of the new grant programs that we've just introduced, those are open to individual artists. So if an artist wanted to tour his or her work, or if an artist wanted to work in, say, a community center to offer classes, they could apply for a project-specific grant.
Madam Chair? Mrs. Jennings, then could they also be awarded both, or does the Arts Board and the Regional Councils communicate to clarify if one has already awarded a grant to that artist, they then are disqualified? Do you know what I'm saying? Can they get both grants, or can they only be awarded one if they've applied to two?
Ms. Jens.
Madam Chair, Representative Mack, they can receive more than one grant. They can receive one from a Regional Arts Council or a grant from a Regional Arts Council and also a grant from the State Arts Board. Generally, we would assume that they're providing different kinds of projects to the different to the two different places. And with the number of artists in Minnesota, we know that any one artist is going to receive a very small amount of funding from the two sources together, even if they did get two grants.
Just one more quick question, Madam
Go
Chair.
Ahead.
Thank you. Last question. When I was looking on your website, and from what you said earlier, it appears, and if you could clarify that if this is wrong, that the State Arts Board, like you said, tends to be more career advancement type opportunities, fellowships, like you said. So would that be to say that some of the State Arts Board grants tend to be more one-time type opportunities rather than sustainable programming in a community, whereas Regional Art Council grants are more sustainable, ongoing programming, trying to get something up and started type of a thing? And then the second part of the question is there a cap to the largest amount of grant that could be given or no?
Ms. Jens.
Madam Chair, Representative Mack, you're absolutely right about our artist grants. They have to be used for a specific career or artistic development opportunity. The cap in that program is $6,000 right now. I can't really speak to your question about are artists receiving ongoing support from regional arts councils. My instinct is probably not, but I don't know that for sure. I think that those are project grants as well, and the likelihood of the same artist being awarded the grant year after year after year is unlikely. In our case, we do say that if an artist receives a grant in one round, they are not eligible the next year for a grant. We do try to spread those dollars around for artists.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Gans. First of all, I'm looking forward someday to having arts performances in the Litchfield Opera House once we get enough money to finish that. But my question is, of the money that you receive in general fund appropriations, excluding legacy money, what amount do you use for grants?
Ms. Jens.
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, we are trying to remember the exact percentage. I believe it's 95% of the funds that come from the general fund go out as block grants to the regional arts councils and arts board grants. We're using less than 5% for administrative purposes.
Thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Jens, if you could just get us some sort of summary information, you don't have to have it now, about sort of like the range of grants for individual nonprofits through this, and then what the range of support is for individual artists. I think that would be helpful. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, we'll be happy to provide that to you. What I'd like to do is to provide that to you as we get a little closer to awarding grants so that we can give you better information about that.
Now, refresh my mind again. When are you going to be awarding the grants?
Madam Chair, the big day for us is May 5th.
May 5th.
That's my son's birthday.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you,
this
members of the committee.
This was very helpful.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Commissioner Klinsing and State Librarian Suzanne Miller. Minnesota libraries. The libraries had a statistical report that was due on January 1st, I think, or December, and we would like a brief overview of that, if you're prepared. No, you're not prepared.
Yes, prepared.
You are. Oh, it's not in there. Okay. But mainly we're here tonight to find out how you were ready to, or what happened to the money that was presented to the libraries for presentation across the state for the legacy dollars. And I might say that when the librarians, or when it was Library Day here, and the advocates from across the state and the library board members from the regional library systems that came to visit, they were as enthusiastic as the arts people were the following week about who was coming and what was done and how wonderful the program was. And so we would like a review, more of a review of that. So if you could tell us how the money was spent.
Madam,
I understand. I will start off by saying we understand that in our bill, we do need what other groups had. If they had money left from 1 year, it could carry forward into the next year, because some regional library systems did not have their plan done as quickly as others, I believe. So, Ms. Miller.
Madam Chair, would you like me to start with the statistical report, or would you prefer that I move on to the legacy?
I'd prefer that you move on to the legacy, because the statistical one, it isn't in our packets. So we will ask you to come back another time.
Well, as all of the previous testifiers, I am here to, on behalf of the libraries across the state, to say thank you again, and I'm happy to be able to do that. This has been a very energizing and exciting and positive program at a time when libraries are facing other difficulties. So it's really nice to have this opportunity to do some really wonderful things in our communities. Libraries are particularly important and appropriate places for this particular program, because we are found in even the smallest communities, and we run from border to border to border to border in the state of Minnesota. So this really covers the entire state, and it offers an opportunity for people who cannot travel, as well as people who just have not had an opportunity, or perhaps are not even aware of some of the artistic and cultural opportunities available to them, whether they come to the cities or they stay in their smaller communities. I just wanted to go over a few of the highlights here. The funding is distributed through the 12 regional systems. The Department of Education strictly distributes the funding. And then the regions report to the Department of Education on how they have expended the funds. The report that you should have received is based on the first report that they submitted to us, covering July 1 through December 31. So many things have happened since December 31st, but I will focus on what actually happened in the fall, because some of the libraries were able to get up and running and really move quickly into programming. But one of the things they did was certainly to make sure that they had a planning structure in place. All of the regions have a planning committee that oversees the distribution and the use of the legacy funding. 10 of them actually held public forums, public meetings, to find out how their local communities would see this funding expended through their libraries. And the other two have used other methodologies. One of them used a survey, and another one is planning additional meetings this spring. So they all are making sure that they are in touch with what their regional groups really want to see in their libraries. Some of them have picked themes
So that in Kichigami Regional System, they picked Kichi Reads, Kichi Writes, and Speak It, Sing It. This actually represents not only that they're, the people in that area would be able to meet and hear from writers, from Minnesota writers on what they're doing, but also helping to cultivate the people themselves as writers so that we continue the culture of writing and that concept of committing to paper what our memories are, what the culture is at the time right now, so that not only are we hearing about our history today, but developing the history of today for tomorrow's people and children and citizens. Pioneer Land is working on building our legacy through the arts, and certainly Plum Creek is working with the two of the other regions. They've done a multi-regional system to talk about connecting Minnesota readers with Minnesota writers. Like, obviously, literacy is a very big part of this. We want to make sure that there is a connection to our reading and to literacy, because, of course, that's a lot of what libraries are about. But we're about so many other things, because we're keepers of the culture as well. The 12 regional directors, much like in the State Arts Board, have an informal group that they participate in. The regional directors have set aside 10% of their allocation this year to work on a statewide program to make sure that everyone in the state has an opportunity to work together on a single theme. And that theme is the greatest generation in libraries. And it's focusing on the, and actually building upon, the History Center's Minnesota's Greatest Generation project that is up and running at the History Center. This is being done in collaboration with the History Center so that we can take what has been done here in the History Center, expand on it, document and push this out into greater Minnesota. It has three key goals: to document and preserve the community stories so that if you are in a rural area, that the stories of the greatest generation can be preserved in your local area. Also, to educate people of all ages so that we don't lose the stories and that young people have the opportunity to learn from an intergenerational experience. And bringing the generations together into the, to share community histories and expanding it through different types of media. This Greatest Generation project has just gotten up and running. The part of the funding was used to contract with a person to run that Greatest Generation project. She works out of the History Center, and they are collaborating with the History Center to bring this together. So this is, we're really leveraging each other's dollars to make sure that the best and high quality of a high quality program can be taken out into the more rural areas, but also that the expertise of both the History Center as well as libraries can be brought to bear on this particular program. In addition, beyond that, each region will produce programming that's most specific to their area based on these community forums. To date, as in the fall, 23 unique programs were provided as of December 31st. Now, 23 sounds like very small, but it wasn't just 23 programs. They were provided in multiple places, multiple locations. There actually were 90 communities that experienced those 23 programs. You'll note that over 2,293 attendees at those programs, and they covered a broad and vast spectrum of experience. So that we're covering arts, not both music, visual, literary, performing, dance, and certainly emphasizing cultural heritage. The regional library systems really want to be focused on and clearly respond to the intent of the amendment. So making sure that we've connected to all the different cultural activities as well as to responding even to the clean water aspect of this.
One of the libraries was doing a program using the Zoomobile, and the purpose of it was to introduce children to conservation and nature and how to ensure that the environment stays vibrant for the future and of their generations. The regional libraries were encouraged to develop partnerships, and we have developed 12, they had, as of December 31st, developed 12 new partnerships, and it included some of the testifiers here today. We've worked with the Arts Board, we've worked with the Perpich Center, and certainly the Rochester is just now mounting an exhibit in collaboration with Mayo Clinic. So they have continued to develop new partnerships that they might not have developed in other situations. Not only that, but they have been able to leverage additional funding to match or marry with the legacy funds. So again, making those dollars go further than they might have. Just to mention a couple of specific programs, there are several specific programs that are listed in the report, but I wanted to kind of touch on a couple of programs that aren't there. One of them is with the Perpich Center that was done. There are four students from the Perpich Center that were engaged by the Arrowhead system. Two of them were pianists, and they actually offered piano recitals in the Duluth Public Library. It gave them the opportunity to perform and connect with the people that helped to raise them. They were connecting back to their communities. Certainly that also helps the community to understand better what the Perpich Arts Center does for their children. And it's certainly a good opportunity for development of the Perpich Center future generations. Also from the Perpich Center, there was a photography exhibit and an artistic exhibit. Again, doing the same thing, giving students, future artists, an opportunity to work with and do things in a new and better way. In addition, in addition to the Greatest Generation Project, the regional libraries have joined together to develop an artistic database of artists and performers who are appropriate for working in libraries. And this is up and running on the Southeastern Libraries Cooperating website. It's open for use by anyone, but the database has been developed to help libraries find high-quality programs that they can provide in their libraries. It includes the kinds of criteria like space that's necessary, time of the activities, how much time it takes for the particular activity, and things like that. So it is a fully vetted list. As you can see in the report, there are several things there, and many additional programs that I just included a sampling of the programs that were presented in the fall. With that, and I want you to watch your libraries, because there will be many, many more activities this spring. They have started the up and running, everything from programs for children, programs for adults, and intergenerational activities to try to continue to best expose our communities to the best that Minnesota has to offer. And with that, I would invite your questions and comments.
Well, I just want you and the committee to know that in the toddlers group, I was a bluebird. We danced. We flew in, and we flew out, and we flew above. It was great.
This is recently?
It was on a snowy day in December, yes. Very snowy day, so we all had our boots on, too.
Hard to fly with your boots
on. It's hard
to
fly with your boots on. But the little kids and I, we managed. Representative Lilly.
Madam Chair, when we're done, I just have a question for the Assistant Commissioner related to the blind. Is that appropriate here, or?
When we're done. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and we all kind of rushed into some of these things, but, and we did it direct that existing formulas be used in the distribution of these funds, but I have to say, I hope that by next year we're willing as a committee to revisit this, because they use the basic system support grants, which are really about keeping the doors open, the lights on, and an adequate collection in every part of the state. And so it's tilted towards the more rural areas so that they can have a minimal access library, or, you know, one that adequately meets people's needs. And I agree with that. But when you use it for programming is really related to the audience rather than keeping the heat bills paid. And I think we need to think about whether or not this is the right formula and develop one that's more related to the people, the number of people to be served, because the grand total was $4,250,000, and MELSA, which is the metro region, which is the 7-county metro area, got less than a third, even though it has over half the population, to try and provide programming for. And so I think between now and next session, I would really like to work with people to see what we think would be a reasonable distribution, because that formula was never designed for programming, which is really about audience. Rather than collections and heat bills and things like that basic support is for.
Ms. Miller, comment?
Certainly we'd be willing to work with Representative Loeffler and others on looking at alternatives to the distribution. The one comment I would have is there is a set cost, and when you go far afield geographically, you'll notice Viking, for instance, only received $108,000. It will be limited as far as how much programming they will be able to offer because of that. And the cost of an artist to come in is really not reduced because you happen to be far away in the rural area. And again, libraries do try to leverage additional funding and marry it to other funding streams to make sure that we provide things in a more equitable and distributed fashion.
Madam Chair, just to that point,
Representative Loeffler.
I do hope that, as you saw from the earlier presentation, there are wonderful, talented artists in every corner of the state, and I'm hoping that more of them will step up to this opportunity. It may be that there's certain ones who are better marketing themselves to say, come hire us and we'll come up to wherever you are. I'm hoping that we'll get actually more local talent seeing this as an opportunity to reach out to new communities, not just in the arts, but in history and the culture of their particular area. I mean, we have county historical societies in all parts of the state that are trying to build new audiences and things. So I'm hoping that as this evolves, we just get more and more creative.
Representative Loeffler, I would say that's exactly what's happening. For instance, in Pipestone, a local historian talked about the Pipestone legacy in the Pipestone area. And when East Central celebrated its 50 years as a regional library system, they used local artists to enhance their celebrations using legacy funds. So they found that they had 3 or 4 harpists in the area that they used in the libraries. They found a wonderful string group of young people, high school group, that performed in the library. They definitely did, and so it is happening that they are cultivating those local artists and helping them to grow in their craft.
Commissioner Clinzing, do you have anything to add about what you've heard about the legacy dollars?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I was pleased to see the local flavor that was brought forward in the library grants that were already starting to be utilized. In fact, my daughter was very excited to see Laura Ingalls Wilder mentioned somewhere in the report. She was only 8, and she wanted to know what I was reading, so I handed it to her, and that was the one word that she recognized. But and then additionally, I would just say to Representative Loeffler's request for us to work with the committee. Certainly, we're executing, of course, the committee's direction at how to disperse those funds and would probably need some more direction if we were to stray from that approach. So would urge, yes, we'll work with you, but would urge you to work with each other on that as well.
Thank you. Commissioner, any other questions about the legacy dollars? Okay. Commissioner, are you up to a question about the Braille and Talking Books Library?
Always.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Assistant Commissioners. Is it my understanding that the Braille Library is under the jurisdiction of the Department of Education?
That's correct.
Madam Chair and Assistant Commissioner, how does it fit under your jurisdiction?
Chair Murphy, Representative Lilly, the Braille Talking Book Library is part of the Library Services Division, and that division is one of the divisions that is in the agency. We have a division of assessment, a division of school improvement, and in this case, the division of State Library Services is one that I supervise.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, thank you. So you're fully aware that we've had some questions in this committee ongoing regards to staffing concern. Can you tell me where you're at currently with staffing in the regards to that library?
Commissioner Clinzing.
Thank you. Chair Murphy, Representative Lilly, I don't have the exact figures in my head. I'm sure that Suzanne does because we were just working on the updated spreadsheet for this year, but I do know that last year we were still in the fiscal year where we did add one state-funded position and one federally-funded position to Braille Talking Book Library. We added two positions since the previous fiscal year.
Representative Lilly.
Madam Chair and Commissioner, we've just recently had some concern about that you're not fully staffing, and is there a set date that you plan to be fully staffed, or is this a position that you're going to leave these positions open?
Commissioner Clinzing.
Thank you, Chair Murphy, Representative Lilly. As I said, we're at 9.5 full-time staff right now at the, 9.5 full-time equivalencies, and we were at 7.5 last year at the same time.
Madam Chair, I appreciate your answer. What would you consider full staffing, though? My understanding, it's quite a bit higher number.
Commissioner Clinzing.
Chair Murphy, Representative Lilly, full staffing is a term I'm not familiar with. And it just is not a term I'm familiar with. We're funding to the level at which we're receiving funding, and there is some additional federal funding now that's come in over the year, and we're working on the paperwork to get that actually approved as a critical funded position so that we can fill those additional positions.
Madam Chair.
Representative Lilly.
And Assistant Commissioner, is it your understanding that some positions might be set to expire?
Commissioner Clinzing.
Chair Murphy, Representative Lilly, pretty much all positions can be set to expire at any given time when budgets are being reduced. In this case, if you're referring to a couple of positions that were temporarily filled, those positions, I can't speak to whether we'll be able to renew those, but given what I'm looking at with respect to the budget and the federal funding coming in, I think that we'll be able to staff using that federal funding, and they will see we'll probably not see a reduction in funding from where they're at right, or I'm sorry, staffing from where they're at right now. But those positions that you may be referring to as, quote, potentially expiring at the end of the fiscal year, are positions that, I'm sorry, would not potentially end until fiscal year, the end of this fiscal year, which ends on June 30th. And we don't make these kinds of decisions at this point because you're still deciding what our budget's going to be. So given the federal funding that's there, I do think we'll be able to maintain the amount of staffing that's there. But with if it's a state-funded position, I can't guarantee that at this point because our budgets won't be decided until mid-May or end of May.
Representative Lilly.
Madam Chair and Assistant Commissioner, then I'm really quite happy you're here then today because then you can give me some direction and maybe the committee as far as your vision for your department. Would you like to have more staff or as you as a commission assistant commissioner, do you want to fill these positions with you mentioned state money, but is it a priority to you and this governor of the state of Minnesota to fund this?
Commissioner Clancy.
Chair Murphy, Representative Lilly, the budget reductions that the state has incurred have been across the board for every agency and every division. No division has been singled out or targeted more than any others. And at this point, I don't see a change in that direction. And so given, as I said, given where the budget reductions, the level at which we're at for budget reductions at the state level, not positive we can hang on to the temporary state position that we were able to fund last year, or I mean this current fiscal year. But I do know that we can, given the federal funding that's there, probably be able to fund two, maybe three positions.
Madam Chair and,
Representative
and Assistant Commissioner, I realize you're, I mean, just to draw like a picture maybe. I mean, you're from Woodbury and they've had great basketball teams. And do you want these folks to go to court, to be on the court, a basketball court with five people, or do you want them, I mean, what's the number you want? Do you want to play short, or do you want to play, you know, 3-on-5, or what's your vision for our state? You know, I mean, you keep talking about the federal money. You are the appointee of the governor, is that correct? I mean, it is. So, I mean, what is your vision, your leadership? What is your vision for the state of Minnesota? I guess I'd like to hear.
Commissioner Clancy.
Chair Murphy, Representative Lilly, I do value the Braille Talking Book Library, which is why I worked very hard last year in a time when other divisions were cutting positions and cutting budgets. I worked hard to get, even if you see it as temporary funding, to get the only funding that we could find at that time to increase the staffing at the Braille Talking Book Library what I think was workable. A visit down there, I think that I've been down there to visit to see how things are operating. And with their transition to the digital books, it's the in 2007, just as I was coming on board, the request had been whether, I'm sorry, the point that had been made at that time is that with the technology, they were going to need less staffing. And that staffing at that time in 2001, that many people hearken back to 2001, 2002, was around 11. So the hope was for technology and modern technology to actually reduce the absolute number of people that needed to be there. Now, we've not necessarily heard that that's the case. So I'm not sure that digital technology is replacing the people power that that use the Braille Talking Book Library and the staff there said that it might. Given that we are only about 1.5 positions away from what others call optimal, and I'm still trying to determine whether in this age of modern technology we really can go below what others say is the optimal level of 11. I think that for now, 9.5 is working out pretty well given the what we have to work with budget-wise. But I can't tell you what an optimal level is.
Madam Chair.
Commissioner Klein saying that 9.5 is one or two people more than we had a year ago.
It is two, Madam Chair.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just in closing, I guess I have a little different vision for the state of Minnesota, and I'm disappointed that you and as commissioner are not committed to fulfilling a promise, if you will, to these people that need an expanded opportunity, and especially given the jurisdiction of a library. I mean, it's to me, if libraries opens up a world and you're opening up a place for these folks to go and to see and to feel and to hear. So I'm disappointed, and you may be close now, but I mean, if you lose those two positions, you're not going to be close. And so I don't know. I guess at this point, I agree to disagree. So thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for your time.
Representative Hawes.
Thank you. Maybe you can kind of educate me so I'm kind of squared away on this. When I first worked with this problem, the people from my area were concerned that the hiring freeze was in effect and that there was a federal positions not being hired, and they didn't understand why the federal money was tied up with the hiring freeze. And now I hear that you hired a federal person and a state person or with that. Isn't that correct? Mm-hmm. Isn't that what you're saying? Now, the two positions, does that mean the hiring freeze was lifted for those? You requested that? How did that work?
Thank you.
Commissioner Clancy.
Thank you, Chair Murphy, Representative Hawes. Actually, you're right that there, we were able to execute the paperwork to deem that this was a critical function, which is why I disagree with Representative Lilly that I've not prioritized the Braille Talking Book Library under my leadership, because most of the decreases to this happened long before my tenure it ever started in this area, and even before actually the governor came too. So I think that we've placed a priority on making sure that these particular positions are deemed critical functions and that they are there to open up that world for those people who need this service. We do not have a freeze per se. There are hiring restrictions is the name for it at the Minnesota Management and Budget Office. Under the hiring restriction, the process is it does take longer to fill positions, so we can never fill them very quickly anyway, but this adds a layer of paperwork, or we have to fill out a hiring restriction exemption.
Right.
And so we did do that in this case. And with the federal funds that are now there for this fiscal year, we should be able to maintain two federally funded positions that would be in addition to the 7.5 positions that we were at last year. So we should be able to maintain, if not increase a little bit.
Madam Chair.
Representative Haas.
Just one more question that educates me. If you do not use the federal money for a position, it is available for other operating expense. Is that true? And if it is true, have you used those federal dollars for operating expenses rather than for labor expense or position?
Commissioner Clancy.
Chair Murphy, Representative Hawes, I'm going to have our Library Services Director answer this question because she's more familiar with the federal language, with how with respect to how these funds can be dispersed.
Thank you.
Ms. Miller.
Madam Chair, Representative Haas, the funds that are not expended for the purpose of personnel would be redirected either to a statewide project, which would serve the citizens, or it would be go into a competitive grant process that we conduct every year. So the funds are redirected to projects that go out for library services. We do not use it for operating within the department.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Commissioner, thank you for your clarification tonight.
You're welcome.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anyone in the audience that came to testify on their use of legacy funds or on their experience with the use of legacy funds? Okay. Representative Haas, the minutes.
Oh, yes. I would like to approve the minutes here. And the minutes are from March 10th. Mm-hmm. And is there a March 15th?
Nope.
March 10th. We didn't write them fast enough for March 15th, did we?
Not ready. And they're not ready.
They're said, but not recorded.
That's correct.
Thank you.
And not printed. Representative Haas moves adoption of minutes as printed. All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Thank you very much. Thank you for your patience, your endurance. This meeting is adjourned.